Okay, hello. Hello again. As I just said, I'm Guido Günther, and this talk is about LibVirt, which is a library which aims to make virtualization a little bit easier, especially with the sheer amount of virtualization solutions we have in Debian. Fortunately, in Debian, we can pick off about any virtualization solution that's available on the Linux, like QEMU, KVM, Xen, VirtualBox, Linux Containers, OpenVZ, or User Mode Linux. And this is actually a very nice thing. But the problem with this is some of these virtualization solutions either don't have a stable API to work against, or they kind of tend to change the command line syntax from release to release. And well, at least in my case, it's if I have to use more than one or two virtualization solutions, I always forget how to add a new disk, how to add a new device to the virtual machine, because it's all different between these solutions. And so LibVirt aims to abstract these common pieces of the virtualization solutions and provide an ABI to be able to use always the same ABI and command line interface to do these kind of things. Just as I just said, so we are aiming for a stable command line interface to manage virtual machines, and we're also aiming for a stable configuration file format, and we're aiming for a stable API so the programs we write don't break with every new version of a virtualization solution. The format is XML-based, which is not everybody's favorite, and obviously not all features supported by all hypervisors are available in LibVirt. This has two reasons. One reason is that the hypervisors supported don't have a different feature set. So one hypervisor might support net device hot plugging, another probably not. And even if both support net device hot plugging, it might not be the driver in LibVirt might not implement this at this point in time. So you have a stable API, but you won't have all the features maybe available in a certain version of LibVirt. But the features certainly will only increase over time. When you use LibVirt as a virtualization API, you have a command line interface that uses this library. It's called Virsh, and it simply offers all the commands you would expect to have for a virtual machine lifecycle. Like, you can list all the available virtual machines on a host. You can get the domain information, which is kind of how much RAM it currently uses and these things. You can get a description of the XML format currently used. You can define new domains. You can edit a domain, which simply you can just say Virsh edit, and then the name of the virtual machine, which will spawn your editor, and you can edit in it and then say save, and the configuration is adjusted. You can start new domains. You can destroy them, and you can, of course, shut them down. Then there's save, restore, suspend, resume, migrate, what you probably would expect. And on top of that, there's also some statistics functions, so you can get some block device statistics, or you can get some domain, some interface statistics for network devices, and you've got all the necessary command line things to attach and detach new disks, new network devices, or to pass in like USB devices from the host to the virtual machine, or PCI devices, for example. Another area which LibVirt covers, and which also Virsh, the command line tool, covers, are tools to manage disk images. So you can LibVirt tries to organize disk images in storage pools, and these pools, in the simplest case, this is just a directory. You can just list them, get information about it, can again get the XML definition, and so on and so forth. And if you look at this, this basically maps most of the command line arguments map the things in the above, so which makes it pretty consistent. Same goes for networking. LibVirt has quite simple interface to define networks for virtual machines, and again you have some set of commands in Virsh that lets you modify them, and again they look pretty much the same than the ones above. Last but not least, you have some support for enumerating host devices. Like, you can list the PCI devices or the USB devices in the host, so you can easily get the necessary XML descriptions to attach them to a virtual machine. The whole point about this is that all these commands come in blocks. Like, different because they operate on different aspects of virtualization. And in these blocks, they're usually prefixed with something like net or pool or node dev in this case, but they're all pretty consistent between these areas. So once you've used Virge on the command line, and I just picked some of the commands you'll be using to start and stop virtual machines. It's actually quite easy to get started with using the C library itself, because again, the C library maps pretty much to the command line interface. So if you want to list all domains, you have in the C library, you have an interface which is just called connect list domains, which lists you all the running domains. You have a function corresponding to the info above, which is called ver domain get info to get the domain information. You have a function in the C library to get the XML description, which is dump XML from above from the command line interface. You have a function to define new virtual machines via XML, which is called in the C library domain define XML, and it's just called define above. You have a function to start a domain, which is in libvirt, unfortunately called ver domain create, because it's start in the command line interface, but destroy and shutdown just map directly to the C API. So the whole point here is that once you just know your way around the command line, you basically know how to program libvirt. The other nice thing, actually, I think, is libvirt itself is written in C, but you have bindings for lots of languages. So you have Python bindings, you have Perl bindings, you have Objective Camel bindings, and you have Ruby bindings. All of these are already available in Debian. There are also Java bindings, but they are not yet packaged, because I'm not that much interested in Java, but if anybody has interest in this, we can do this too. I want to show a very short example on how to actually access libvirt's API. I've picked Python because it's just a little bit more dense than the C code, but the function calls actually map quite well to each other. Of course, as in Python, you import the libvirt module, and then the first thing you do is you open a connection to libvirt in order to tell it what kind of hypervisor you want to use. So in this case, we want to use QEMU, which as hypervisor, and we want to use a system QEMU, which means we want to use a QEMU that runs as root and is spawned by a daemon that is called libvirt. We'll see what that is just in a couple of minutes. And then we get back a connection object, and then we can, just as in the C API we saw just before, we can list the domains and get back the domain IDs of the running domains, and then we can look up each domain by its ID and get back a domain object, and we can just call the name attribute and we get the names of all running virtual machines. So it's actually quite simple. One other nice thing in libvirt, which actually isn't in the command line interface because it just makes no sense there, is libvirt has an event-driven call. Can just say, I've got a program that is interested when my virtual machine crashes because I want to send a mail to root or something like that. And that's actually quite simple too, because you just say you want to domain event register a callback. In this case, it's simply called domain event callback, and you can just pass on some additional data if you want to, but we don't in this case. And then you just define your callback, which just has a connection object, a domain object, event information, a detail of the happening event, and the data we probably passed in below. So this makes it actually quite easy to not only to start and stop virtual machines, and you don't have to check if this is actually running, because libvirt will actually tell you if the machine crashed or if somebody saved the domain. There's a small library called libvirt glib, which just makes this even simpler to plug it into the glib loops, or if you're writing a GTK-based program, that's probably not real from the back, it's gtk.main. Here it's entering the GTK main loop. The nice thing is you just have one additional call, and it's part of your glib main loop, and you just can use a GTK-based program. So in order to show this a little bit, I've just written a very, very short program, which I just called vmapplet, and it's actually quite stupid because it just doesn't anything more than the slide I just showed before. It just listens for domain events. So, yes, I sure. So, but it's actually, yeah. Does that help? I can increase it even further. So, just starting virtual domain, and with the VM applet, which is just sitting in my system tray here, got a notification, and it just shows that the domain has been started. So it's actually quite simple. So I can save the domain to a file. I have to tell it what the file should be called. And I again get a domain event, and interesting are the domain details, because it tells me that the domain has been saved. So it tells me the domain has been stopped and it has been saved to a file. And I can restore the virtual domain, something like this, and it says again the domain has been started and the virtual machine has been restored. So in contrast to the virtual machine has just been booted. So that's actually quite nice and quite simple interface. The point about all this is basically the Python program is actually a little bit longer than what is on this slide, but there's no other libvirt-related call in it. So the rest is just the GTK stuff for getting it in the tray and all this. So how does this all look from the above? The application, like VM applet or Virsh, the command line interface, just links against libvirt, obviously, and then uses the API of libvirt, which is here, and libvirt itself called has a list of drivers for all the different virtualization solutions. And in almost every case, it just goes to the remote driver and then uses the URL we provided just in the beginning, and this tells, in this case of QEMU, to call into libvirt. Libvirt is the daemon I've just mentioned, which runs on the system. Libvirt itself calls into libvirt again and uses the QEMU driver to manage all these virtual machines. It also, it would be pretty much the same if we say we wanted to create a new virtual machine image. This would be pretty much the same. The application would call, it would use the libvirt API, it would use the remote driver, it would call into libvirt, and it would then not use the QEMU driver but the storage driver and create a new virtual machine disk image. The big advantage of having something like this is that you can very, very easily do all the virtual machine management on remote systems too by just changing this URI and just making sure there's some kind of transport available to the remote system. So what kind of URIs would we expect in these cases? So that we already had QEMU system, which means we are using a libvirt daemon that runs with root privileges and so it's able to do pretty much everything on the systems. The, another URI for QEMU and KVM is session, which means there will be a libvirt daemon started with permissions of the with a UID of the user. This will automatically be started if you use session, and so you don't have it running as root. In the case of Linux containers, the URI would just be lxc --/// and in the case of Xen, it would be Xen. When you in the case of you, for example, when you call into libvirt, how are the permissions managed? It's quite simple. There's a socket on in var run for the system libvirt, and whoever has read-write permissions to this socket has permissions to add, modify, delete virtual machines. So he has full access to the system, and access to this socket on Debian is handled via a POSIX group, which is just libvirt. And if you're a member of this group, you have full access, and if you're not a member of this group, you don't. So since this is pretty powerful, and you might have users that should only be able to, for example, get a VNC connection to the virtual machine, so they don't have any management capabilities, just only can get a graphical display, there's also read-only access handled with another socket, which is var run libvirt, libvirt socket minus read-only at the end. And on Debian, by default, every user has access to this socket, so everybody is basically able to get a VNC display. For desktop systems, you can also edit the libvirt configuration and use PolicyKit for all that, so you don't have to use any groups. Just the person using the X session will be able to access the socket, and just some, and then you can define by PolicyKit the rest of the permissions. So as I already mentioned, the advantage of having such a daemon is that you can very easily handle remote access. So by just as a kind of a transport just behind the QEMU or behind the Xen in this case, you can just access remote hosts that also have virtual machines. And there are several transports available. One of the simplest ones is SSH. In this case, it will just do SSH into the remote machine and call netcat on the socket above, on the var run libvirt socket. And TCP means we are really connecting to the remote Livert daemon via TCP. This has some advantages because we can use SSL authentication like Kerberos, and we can use SSL client certificates if we want to. As an additional thing, Virt Manager, which is an application that is responsible, well, we'll see that later, but this is the graphical user interface for managing virtual machines, can also tunnel the VNC session over SSH, so you can get the display of the machine on the remote host. Yes, go ahead. Yeah, okay. Okay, the system daemon is just started via an init script and runs with root privileges. And the session daemon runs as your user and runs with your user ID. So.
Okay, so the system daemon, in order to be able to talk to it, I have to have access to these sockets, right?
Right.
And the session daemon, I can use that to manage my own
yes.
KVMs under my own.
Exactly, and so you don't you use another socket which is in your home gear and home directory, and you automatically have access to that socket because it's created with your user. And quite often you can actually use the session thing, but if you want to create network devices or something like that, you need privileges you don't have as normal user. So if anybody has another question, just interrupt me, and we can just do that in between. So I now want to give a short overview on the tools we have available that already use libvirt in Debian. And there are several of them already. And one of them is the virtinst group of programs. One of them is virtinstall, which you can just use to install new virtual machines. It's virtclone if you want to clone an existing virtual machine. Then there's Virt Manager, which is the graphical user interface. There's Virt Viewer, which basically is only there to access the VNC for the machine, but you don't have to figure out the port where the VNC display is. You just give it the name of the virtual machine, and it will do the rest by itself. VirtTop is a top-like tool. It's just, instead of showing processes, it shows virtual machine CPU time and memory usage. And we have a set of plugins for Moonin, so you can quite easily monitor your virtual machines using Moonin and the whole. Sorry? Sure.
Sorry. I'm pretty certain that is good. I think.
Okay, thanks. So the whole point about these Moonin plugins is that you don't have to do any configuration. You just tell it which kind of hypervisor you want to use, and it will pick up all the virtual machines running and start drawing some graphs about memory usage and block device statistics and network interface statistics and these things. There's also the guestfs, which is not virtual machine related, but more related to the images of virtual machines. This is a library that allows you to very easily manipulate images of virtual machines. So if you have an image of a virtual machine which uses LVM and which uses maybe some encryption or something like that, it's quite hard because you have to do a loop mount and you have to all activate the volume groups in that thing. And libguestfs tries to figure out most of this by itself, so you can edit virtual machine images without being root on the machine. There will be more about that later. So let's look at virtinstall first. Virtinstall is, as I already said, it's the tool to set up new virtual machines, and since we're supporting different hypervisor solutions, we always have to tell it which hypervisor we actually want to use, and in this case it's again QEMU. We're again using the process that has root privileges, so we're using system and not session, and the virtual machine should be called Lenny, and it should have 256 megabytes of RAM. And we're telling virtinstall that the OS type is Linux and the OS variant is Debian Lenny. What would this be useful for? Actually, virtinstall tries to figure out and tries to be as smart as possible when it comes to speeding up virtual machines. So if you, for example, if your guest supports Vert.io, it wants to enable it just from the installation point of view, and Debian Lenny supports Vert.io in Debian installer, and Debian Edge doesn't. And so if you tell it Debian Lenny, it will use Vert.io, and if you tell it Debian Edge, it will just pick what was available in Lenny. In the case of QEMU, it would be IDE. The nice thing about, so this is the OS type of the guest, I should add. It's not the host, it's the guest. This, it might be pretty obvious for anybody here when it comes to Debian. For me, it's very helpful if I wanted to do, like, say, Windows virtualization, because I don't know which version of Windows supports ACPI or APIC, and which version of OpenSUSE supports Vert.io. And by just specifying the right OS type and the OS variant, Vert install will just figure it out by itself and do the right thing. Of course, you can override that on the command line. We should see that on a minute. So import means we don't want to create a new disk image. We already have one, and the new image we have is a disk with which sits in a storage pool with a name default and with a name lenny.image. The networking we want to use is QEMU's user mode networking, and the model inside the guest should be Vert.io, so we say model equals Vert.io. That's actually a pretty simple example. We can do something more elaborate with some more command line arguments. The beginning is pretty much the same. We're saying Vert install. I'm just reading this because I think it's quite hard to figure out in the back. So we again use minus minus connect to connect to QEMU. We use minus minus force to stop any prompting for and any user interaction. We again use as name Lenny. We use the same amount of RAM. And this time we want to have a new disk, so we say we want a new image in the pool default, and it should have the size 10 gigabytes, and for caching we want write-back caching. And we want to have a second disk, and this one is already available, so we can specify the volume name, which I will just explain in a second what that is exactly, and it's again in the pool default, and the volume name will be with USB Lenny preseed.image, and we want to have it attached to the bus, to the USB bus of the virtual machine. Again, we want to do user node networking with a Vert.io model, and additionally, we pass the location argument, which is a URL, which is ftpde://debian.org/debian/disk/stable/main/installer e386, and we pass some extra command line arguments to the kernel, which are not, well, which are basically passed to Debian installer then. And the nice thing is then that if you just use this kind of installation, it will fetch the netboot images from Debian, and in this case from stable, so from Debian Lenny, download them, and start Debian installer with the arguments that are just there on the command line. So this is pretty much convenient for Debian installer testing, especially if you add another volume, like in the above example, which adds a USB device with preceding, so you can do fully automated Debian installer testing.
I have another question. How does it know that it should call the installer?
It downloads the kernel and the init.ramfs and passes it onto KVM.
Okay, so location is an argument that gives a URL directory. And you expect our Vert install inspects to find in that directory a kernel and an init.
Yes. And the location argument actually is in a way that it figures out this is a Debian distribution. So the kernel and the init.ramfs are called like this or like that. And if you use another kind of location argument, which points, for example, to a Fedora server, it will do the right thing for a Fedora system. So this is actually quite nice, I think. So we've just had the word storage pool sometimes in this talk, so I wanted to explain a little bit more what that is. Storage pool is actually something pretty simple. It just keeps virtual machine images. And there are several types of storage pools. The simplest thing is, well, I should add, you can do everything without storage pools. It's just convenient to use them. The simplest thing is a directory. So it's a directory-based storage pool. It's just a directory in the file system. Slightly more complex is a file system. No, that's a spelling error. A file system-based storage pool is actually like a directory pool, but it's backed by a block device. So you have to give it a block device and the mount point, and when you activate this kind of storage pool, it will take the block device mounted to that location, and from there on, it will basically look like a directory-based storage pool. You can use disk-based storage pools, which are partitions. You can use LVM storage pools, which are volume groups, and you can use iSCSI-based storage pools too. Each pool has a target, and the target is, like I actually said, a directory or a volume group, and some of them have a source, e.g. a block device. So in the case of the file system-based storage pool, the source would be the block device, and the target would be the directory. I forgot to explain the network-based storage pool. This is basically not a block device, but an NFS export. So it's not much of a difference. Storage pools contain volumes. In the case of directory-based or file systems-based storage pools, these are just files. In the case of LVM-based storage pools, these are the logical volumes. In the case of disk-based storage pools, these are partitions. And like in the case of iSCSI storage pools, these are just the block devices from the other end of the iSCSI server. You can do something a little bit more elaborate, so you can use a backing store in these kind of storage pools, so you just get a base image, which is probably a Lenny installation you want to have, and then you can just put an overlay onto that, and all modifications to that image will just go onto that overlay, and the thing behind that overlay is just called backing store, and so you can just install Lenny once and have several virtual machines which all use the same backing store. This depends on the image format used in the pool, and Qcow2 just supports this out of the box, and this is why it works. So this is all of this is not something libvirt implements, but it always leaves to the tools provided by the hypervisor or the virtual machine. Virt Manager is just the graphical tool to manage virtual machines. It's kind of the verge for the X-Window system, so you can do pretty much everything with it. What you can also do on the command line, so you can just start some virtual machines, remove and add devices, have a graphical display or display of the serial console of the virtual machine. You can display statistics about disk and block devices. You can see this in the image here. I don't know if you can read it from the back. And you can manage storage pools and volumes, and you can manage network stuff. So it's just the graphical representation, probably. I think it's quite useful, and especially since you can just add several hypervisors. So in this case, we're using the local QMU, which is a system QMU in this case, and down there, there's another connection to a machine called PowerBook, which is using Zen, and there's another machine which is using QMU, and we have two times QMU in this image because we're connecting with one connection to the system QMU and with another connection to the session QMU. Okay, another tool in this list is just Virtclone, which is just very simple to clone a virtual machine. So you have one and you want to have another one that looks exactly like this one. And what you do is you again pass on a connection URI. So the bird knows which kind of hypervisor you want to use, and then you say what is the old name of your virtual machine, and you pass in the new name, and then Virtclone just asks you, well, how shall I name the new disk image, and then you just tell it, and it will just copy the machine, and you're done. So you get a new XML definition and all the stuff necessary to start the new virtual machine. So I already mentioned Virtop. It's just a top-like tool. You can see it in the image. It's just display processes, but it displays virtual machines. So it sorts them by CPU usage by default, but you can also sort them by memory usage and see which virtual machines are actually running and which of them are turned off. This is a nice example because it doesn't use the Python bindings as all the rest, but it uses the Objective Camel bindings. So quite new in this libvirt universe is libguestfs, which is a library which is not that much related to virtual machines itself, but to the images that virtual machines use, the disk images. And there's a shell tool that is called guestfish, and there's again lots of language bindings. It's there's libguestfs Perl, which is the Perl bindings, obviously, and Python libguestfs, which are the Python bindings. There are also bindings for Haskell, Java, Ruby, and Objective Camel, but the package we have at the moment doesn't build them at this time. So there's kind of predefined recipes to do certain things with libgizfs, find at the URL http://libgizfs.org/recipes.html. And there are other tools coming with libgizfs like vertdf, vertcat, and vertinspector. Vertdf is just a tool which you just pass it the name of a virtual machine, and it will just look at all the disk images of the virtual machine and see how much free space there is, and just tell you without that's actually the important point, without starting the virtual machine. And vertcat is a tool which just gets you a file from any of the disk images, and vertinspector just tries to analyze the disk images, and it tells you the kernel version in that in the virtual machine images, the modules loaded, and these kind of things. I just added a short example how to use guestfish on the command line. In this case, we are not using an already existent disk image, but we are creating a new one, so we are telling guestfish, please allocate, just by using alloc, Lenny preset image 4 MB, please allocate the 4 MB sparse file, then, and this is probably the most important point. So, in order to look at guest images of virtual machines easily without starting the virtual machine, what is the trick to do this? Well, you start another virtual machine, which is a very small appliance that is shipped with libguestfs itself, which is using QEMU and which is using VM channels to talk to the then booted virtual machine. So you boot this small appliance, and the small appliance just uses the necessary commands like PV display and all these things to figure out the details about the virtual machine disk images. In this case, it's we run the appliance and tell the appliance to create a partition table on DevHDA, and then we tell it to add a partition to DevHDA. Then we tell it to make a VFAT file system and mount that file system. Then we copy a preset CFG and unmount it, quit, and are done. And when we're done with this, and if we think back to the second vert install example, there was a USB disk which was passed into the virtual machine for the Debian installer testing. And so you can basically pretty much automatically create these kind of disk images by using this. And the only thing you have to provide is a preceding configuration. So this is, again, very useful for testing Debian installer with different preceding configurations. Yes, some notes about debugging libvirt problems, debugging libvirt problems in general. There might be problems with some kinds of things because maybe some hypervisor doesn't implement a certain feature, or something is just broken. So there are log files in var log libvirt, and if you, for example, this is a good example. If you're using, for example, QEMU in the system mode, they will be in var log libvirt. If you're using it in session mode, they will be in your home directory in .libvirt. Vert Manager has a nofork option, which puts all its diagnostic outputs onto standard output, which is quite helpful, and also writes a log file in .vertmanager.log. There are also log files for the vert install tools in .vertinst, and if nothing else helps, there are some environment variables you can use. So there's something like libvirt_debug=1, which you can use in front of anything that links against libvirt, for example, libvirt itself, or maybe in front of Virsh, or in front of Vert Manager. And to the libguestfs tools, the environment variable is libguestfs debug. That's about the tools we have. So everybody who's still not really convinced to use libvirt instead of doing all the stuff by hand, there's even in libvirt, there's some kind of API which helps you to migrate your existing domain configuration. So because I've used this most frequently, pick the example of QEMU, and the DOM XML from native call, which is also available from the Virsh command line tool, you pass it in a QEMU command line, and it will output you the XML that is needed to start a QEMU with these parameters. There's also a wiki page which has some more info on how to switch from QEMU to using libvirt. Basically, you're not switching away from QEMU, you're just putting libvirt as a layer over QEMU, of course. So what is missing in libvirt? What is missing is we don't have a nice API for doing snapshots. So you can just snapshot machines and just discard them or go back in time and all these kinds of things, which are actually supported in different hypervisors, but libvirt just offers no API for it. And there's no fine-grained user management. Either you can do everything with the virtual machine or almost nothing, like you only get information to access to a VNC display or display virtual machine configurations. So there's no possibility to have a user that is not able to create new virtual machines but is able to add new disk images or something like that. Fedora actually has some kind of nice SE Linux integration, and Debian doesn't have this at the moment. That would be nice to have. What will come in the next versions of Libert? There's another kind of library on the horizon which is called NetCF, and NetCF tries to abstract the interface configuration. So because every Linux distribution tries to do it in a different way, some of them use if up down and some of them use another way to do it. And so in order to not interfere with all these native mechanisms of Linux distributions, some guys decided to look to write a library which is called NetCF, which allows you to do network configuration in a way the distribution wants it, and this will allow Libvirt to do much more complex network configuration than it can at the moment. And there will be multipath support in one of the coming versions. There will be support for new hypervisors for VMware ESX, if anybody cares. And for Open Nebula, which is actually quite interesting because this is just an interface into your Open Nebula cloud. And for QEMU KVM, there were some features missing, like net device hot plugging, and this will be added, and there will be some enhanced security using C groups in the next version. And well, the Packaging Libvirt group has a mailing list, which is called PKG Libvirt Discuss. Everybody is very welcome to join it and to discuss issues related to Libvirt. And there's the wiki page in the Debian wiki, which is wiki.debian.org/teams/debian-libvirt-team. So that's it.
Sure. Another question from me. You said when you were mentioning the QCOW images, you said you would have like one Lenny install and then you would just track the differences in a QCOW image for other ones. Why would you want to do that?
Well, maybe because you just... I've been using this. Well, I can give an example that I used. I'm always short on disk space on my laptop, so I just made a default Lenny install, and then I wanted to do some clustering tests. So I had basically an image which had all the packages installed, and I have two nodes in my virtual cluster, and they're almost the same. They only differ in the host name. So I just use 1 gigabyte of space instead of 2. So it's just for saving space.
But these are throwaway hosts. You don't keep them because you can't upgrade.
Well, you can, actually.
How are you going to do an upgrade from Lenny to Squeeze?
No, OK. Then I will throw them away. This is just for testing, sure.
OK.
What's the status of Libvirt and Lenny? Is it production ready for servers?
Well, we've been using it, but it's lacking quite some features. So there are backports available on backports.org, which I think they're production ready for servers, and I'd be interested to know if they aren't.
The backports are production ready rather than the packages currently in Lenny.
Yes.
I'll give you my example. I'm currently running a Xen DOM 0 that's still on Etch.
Okay.
The hardware is KVM capable.
Okay.
It looks like I could upgrade to Lenny and migrate everything to KVM given the Xen issues.
Yeah.
This looks like the right way to do it. The machine's in a data center. I don't have easy access.
Okay.
Is this expected to work if I'm careful?
Yes, I think so. Well, actually, I'm using it I'm using it in a production system on Lenny, but not with with KVM, but with Xen. And I've done lots of things with Libvirt and KVM, but not with the version that is actually in Lenny, but with the version that is on backports.org.
Well, actually, I'm using Libvirt with KVM with the little Lenny packages, which mostly works. There's a few things that don't work, which are more related to KVM. So I'm having a funny time trying to hand over USB devices while inserting them and pulling them out again, which the KVM version can't do currently in Lenny, and the other version has some other interesting features which also doesn't really make it easy to hand over USB devices to some embedded Windows 2008 server.
Okay.
But yeah, that's very special. Other than that, with Linux guests, and it really works very well with the Lenny version. So
yeah,
yes.
And in the end, so it's, well, this is kind of hair splitting, but well, in this case, libvirt works, but KVM doesn't. So you would have to use a KVM backport, not a libvirt backport in your case,
well,
right?
Even the KVMs work.
Yeah.
If you just do the standard Linux things,
yeah,
like you forward network devices,
yeah,
only on boot time, you forward only hard disks, that all works very well for me. It just stops the working when you want to dynamically forward USB sticks when they are entered into the computer and revert them if you say are pulled out again. But that's not the standard use case in the data center.
Well, there was something missing in libvirt for quite some time, and this was actually, if you're running KVM instances and you restarted libvirt, you would lose all your libvirt, your KVM machines. And this was actually, we fixed this quite a while ago, but I'm not sure if this is in Lenny. I would just have to look it up. Yeah, okay, so but I think this is in the backports actually, but it's not in Lenny.
Hi, I have a question. What happens if the libvirt daemon is restarted or simply crashes?
In the current versions, nothing should happen. So you just restart it and it will pick up all the running KVM instances and should be fine.
So this has been fixed. Is this in Lenny?
No, it's not in. It's not in Lenny, but it's in the back. I'm almost sure it's in the backport, and it's definitely in unstable and in squeeze.
Okay. And another question for GuestFS: why are you not simply using kpartx on the base system?
Well, because you could, but you have to be root. That's one thing, and especially if you want to do loop mounting and all these kind of things, and. It's kind of, well, that's about it. So you can just, libgetfs tries to just abstract some things out of it. And if you're just very familiar with all these different Linux commands, you need to use kpartx on the system, then activate all the volume groups.
Sorry, no, I meant, why doesn't libvirt or guestfs use simply kpartx instead of booting a new VM? No, but your root argument makes sense.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Do you know whether it's planned supporting libvirt for Linux vServer? Or any plans on it?
No, I don't think at the moment. So, but it's actually it's just the matter of somebody writing a driver. So,
And do you know whether it's difficult or not to write a driver for it?
I'd say it's not that difficult because actually the guys who do most of the libvirt work at Red Hat, they most of the time they even merge partial drivers, so they're merging drivers which only are capable of dumping the XML format but not creating new virtual machines. So you rely on your old tools to create new machines, but so you can just go step by step at networking afterwards and these and that.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you.